To a lesser or greater extent, our lives are shaped by our parents. Some people try to live up to parents' expectations. Some try to escape a parent's shadow. Even when parents are absent, that absence itself can have a formative effect. What if your parents were the greatest heroes who had ever lived? How would that shape you? The Hangover. "This is all my fault," said Tannen glumly, with another groan as nausea welled up inside of him. "What a fool I was not to see this coming." "Don't give yourself all the credit, Big Brother," said Sturm. "I went right along with you. We should have listened to Palin." "No, you shouldn't have," Palin mumbled, closing his eyes at the sight of the sea and sky constantly shifting places in the porthole. "I was being a superior, self-righteous twit, as both of you tried to point out." He was silent a moment, trying to decide if he was going to be sick or not. Finally, he thought he wasn't and added, "We're in this together now, anyway. Either of you know where we are and what's going on?" "We're in the hold of a ship," Tannen said. "And from the sound of it, they've got some great beast chained up there." "A dragon?" Palin asked quietly. "Could be," Tannen answered. "I remember Tannis describing the black dragon that attacked them in Zaxxaroth. He heard a gurgling noise and a hissing, like water boiling in a kettle." "But why would anyone chain up a dragon on a ship?" argued Sturm weakly. "All kinds of reasons," Palin muttered, "most of them nasty." "Probably keep slaves like us in line, Palin," said Tannen in a low voice. "Can you do anything? To free us, I mean? You know, your magic?" "No," Palin said bitterly. "My spell components are gone. Not that I could get to them if I had them, since my hands are tied. My staff, he recalled with a pang. Fearfully, he struggled to sit up, glancing around, then breathed a sigh of relief. The staff of Magia stood in a corner, leaning up against the hull of the ship. For some reason, it did not move when the ship listed, but remained standing perfectly still, seemingly unaffected by the laws of nature. "My staff might help, but the only thing I know how to make it do," he admitted shamefacedly, "is give light. Besides," he added, lying wearily back down, "my head aches so I can barely remember my name, much less a magic spell." The young men were silent, each thinking. Tannen struggled against his bonds once more, then gave it up. The leather had been soaked with water and had tightened when it dried, so it was impossible for the big man to escape. "So it looks like we're prisoners in this wretched hole." "Prisoners," called a booming voice. "Losers, maybe, but prisoners, never." A trapdoor in the ceiling opened, and a short, stocky figure in bright red velvet with black curling hair and beard poked his head through. "My guests you are," cried Dugan Redhammer lustily, peering at them through the hatch. "And fortunate beyond all humans, because I have chosen you to accompany me on my grand quest. A quest that will make you famous throughout the world. A quest that will make that minor adventure your parents were involved in seem like a Kender scavenger hunt." Dugan leaned so far through the hatch that his face became quite red with the exertion, and he almost tumbled through upside down. "We're not going on any quest of yours, dwarf," Tannen said with an oath, and for once, both Palin and Sturm were in full agreement. Leering down at them through the hatch, Dugan grinned. "Wanna bet?" Hello, and welcome to the D&D Book Club. My name is Megan, and today we will be doing something a little different. We will be reading an anthology of novellas by Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman called The Second Generation, published in 1994 by TSR Incorporated. What is a novella, you might ask? Well, it's too short to be called a novel and too long to be called a short story. It falls somewhere in the middle. Maybe you read The Old Man and the Sea in high school or The Metamorphosis in college. Those are examples of novellas from the mainstream literary canon, although there are plenty more. I'm going to be doing this episode a little bit differently. I'm going to break it up into two parts. The first part will cover three of the stories appearing in The Second Generation, specifically the three previously published in other collections. These three collections were all published in 1987 as the Dragonlance Tales Trilogy. I probably won't feature them on this podcast, but I do recommend them. The first story I'll be exploring, Raceland's Daughter, was published in the anthology Love and War. The next story, The Legacy, was published in the anthology The Magic of Kryn. The third story, Wanna Bet, was published in the anthology Kender, Gully Dwarves, and Gnomes. In part two, I'll be discussing the final two stories in the book, as well as doing my analysis of the book as a whole. The final two stories I'll be exploring are The Sacrifice and Kitiara's Son, which first appeared in the second generation. A quick note, I am covering the stories in a different order than they appear in the book. The first story I'm covering, Raceland's Daughter, is a prequel of sorts to the Dragonlance Chronicles trilogy, so I want to do that first. Kitiara's Son is the first story in the book, but I want to save it until later because I want to maintain the chronology. The next book we'll be reading after this two-parter will be Dragons of Summer Flame, for anyone who wants to read ahead. As always, this episode will contain spoilers, so stop listening now if you would rather read this collection first before listening to this episode. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me at dndbookclub@gmail.com. That's DANDD bookclub. Or you can follow me on Instagram at DNDBookClub. Before we get started, I want to give a quick plug for my brand new Patreon. If you don't know, Patreon is a subscription service that allows fans to access premium and bonus creator content. For $5 a month, you'll be able to listen to special monthly bonus episodes of this podcast, featuring the novels inspired by the game Magic the Gathering. You'll also be supporting an independent creator and helping to keep this podcast ad-free. To subscribe, go to patreon.com/dndbookclub. That's DANDD bookclub. There will also be a link in the show notes. Now let us take a look at our first story, Raceland's Daughter. The story begins on a cold, tempestuous night several years before the events of Dragons of Autumn Twilight. The red-robed wizard, Raceland Majeure, traveling with his twin, the warrior Caramon Majeure, arrive at an inn on the outskirts of the Forest of Weyrith. The Forest of Weyrith, you may recall, is a magical wood which conceals the Tower of High Sorcery within from all unwanted trespassers. The Tower of High Sorcery in Weyrith Forest is, at the time of this story, the only occupied Tower of High Sorcery in all of Ancelon, and functions as both an administrative center and a university for all wizards on Ancelon. It is here that novice magic users must come to take the Test of High Sorcery if they wish to obtain the higher levels of arcane power. The test is designed to weed out those who might pose a danger to the established magical order or to the general public. The last thing anyone wants is some lunatic with a spellbook summoning dragons in the middle of a populated city. Magic is already viewed with suspicion by the wider world, and that suspicion nearly led to the destruction of the magical orders during the so-called Lost Battles centuries earlier. The wizards of the Conclave, the ranking magic users on Ancelon, don't want a repeat of that particular fiasco. Raceland Majeure has been to the tower in Weyrith Forest and passed his test, although it very nearly cost him his life. As a result of what occurred inside the tower, Raceland's poor health has become even worse. His skin and eyes have turned gold, and his hair has turned white. Most terrible of all, Raceland has been cursed with pupils in the shape of hourglasses. This is no mere cosmetic defect. His eyes now see everything, people and objects alike, as time will affect them. He sees people growing old and feeble. He sees trees withering and dying. It's like exactly the opposite of beer goggles. The twins arrive at an inn called the Wayward Inn, seeking a room for the night. There is a blizzard on the way, and Raceland is too frail to travel in such weather, or so Caramon thinks. The inn is a dump, the proprietor is a shady grifter, and the inn's patrons are a bunch of churlish ruffians. It's better than sleeping in a snow fort, however, so the brothers settle in by the fire. Raceland orders hot water so he can brew a special tea to ease his cough. He appears so ill that the innkeeper is concerned Raceland is carrying some infectious disease. When we first met Raceland in Dragons of Autumn Twilight, he'd been suffering from the lingering effects of his test for years and learned how to manage his life accordingly. In this story, however, it's brand new to both him and Caramon. A newcomer arrives at the inn, also seeking a room for the night. This newcomer is dressed in loose, baggy clothes and wears a scarf around their face, so at first it's impossible to tell whether it's a man or a woman. One of the ruffians is able to deduce that she is, in fact, a woman and attempts to flirt with her like a drunken incel. He gets a bowl of soup in the face for his efforts. Naturally, this leads to a bar brawl, and the Majeure brothers, being the gallant men they are, attempt to protect the woman. During the fight, the woman's scarf falls from her face, and Raceland gets a clear look at her. She is beautiful, the most beautiful woman Raceland has ever seen, perhaps the most beautiful woman anyone has ever seen. Raceland is taken aback, not only by her beauty, but by the fact that she is not aging and decaying in his sight. Caramon, busy fighting the ruffians, doesn't even notice. Later that evening, Raceland confronts the woman, whose name is Amberil. He hasn't been able to stop thinking about her and is convinced she's cast an enchantment on him. Raceland wants her to remove the enchantment and to explain why she isn't aging. The woman insists she is not quote-unquote magi and that she is aging just like a normal person. But Raceland doesn't believe her. Raceland isn't exactly the romantic type, so apparently it never enters his head that there's another reason he might not be able to stop thinking about her. He's also oblivious to the fact that Amberil is as drawn to him as he is to her. During the night, as the blizzard rages outside, Raceland leaves the inn, venturing blindly into the storm. He's so overcome with this magnetic attraction to Amberil that he feels he has no choice but to leave the inn, despite the weather. Caramon takes off after him. Caramon pursues Raceland back into the forest of Weyreth. They find a small cave and turn it into a crude shelter. Caramon lights a small fire to keep his brother warm, but there is no more firewood, and he's forced to brave the cold to find more. Amberil finds Raceland alone in the cave. At last, Amberil explains what's really happening. She belongs to a race of beings who have lived on Kryn in secret for countless generations. They are few in number, so, in order to reproduce, the young will be sent into the world of humans to find another of their own race and mate. I guess this is their way of keeping the gene pool healthy. Amberil wasn't lying when she said she wasn't magi, but she wasn't being entirely truthful either. Her magical ability wasn't learned as Raceland learned it. Rather, it is innate to her kind. Amberil explains that the magical force which compels her to mate caused her to imprint upon Raceland and him upon her. She doesn't know how it happened, since it's supposed to be impossible for this imprinting to happen with a human, and is completely out of her control. Now, they are both dying, and will die unless they mate and produce a child. Raceland is taken aback, but it's getting awfully cold in this cave, and she's real purdy. Soon, the two are joined in a passionate embrace. When Caramon at last returns, Amberil is gone. Raceland has no memory of what has transpired. The fire is blazing, warming the cave. In the morning, the brothers travel back to the inn. They have no memory of having been there before, and the innkeeper has no memory of them. It's as if the entire incident never took place. Months later, two more strangers arrive at the inn, covered from head to toe. They are members of Amberil's race, who have come to seek her out. One is her brother. There is a pall of sadness over the inn, and the two strangers learn that one of the barmaids died the previous night in childbirth. As it turns out, the barmaid was Amberil, living in disguise among humans while carrying her baby to term. The two pay their last respects, and Amberil's brother takes the child with him to be raised among their kind. The child is a daughter with golden eyes. In a last twist, it is revealed that Amberil and her race were once ogres, but ogres who were never transformed by evil into the ugly, violent brutes we all know and love, and remained the most beautiful among all the races. The name of their race is not explicitly stated in the story, but this race is called the Irida. Part 2, The Legacy. The Legacy begins 25 years or so after the events of the novel Test of the Twins. If you haven't already listened to episode 6, you may want to pause and come back to this episode later. As the story opens, Caramon Magier finds himself back in Weyreth Forest, back in the Tower of High Sorcery. None of Caramon's trips to Towers of High Sorcery have ever been particularly pleasant, so he's understandably on edge. He's been summoned to the tower by the wizard's conclave, now led by the red-robed wizard Justerius. Our old friend, the dark elf Dalimar, Raceland Magier's former apprentice, is now the head of the Order of the Black Robes. A new character, Dunbar Master's mate of Urgoth, heads the White Robes. Caramon hasn't been summoned alone, however. Accompanying him on his trip, although not present for this particular meeting, are his three sons. The eldest is Tannen, a warrior like his father, with red hair and a hot temper like his mother. The second is Sturm, likewise a warrior, but possessing his father's more laid-back attitude. The youngest son is Palin, a slender and studious young man with long auburn hair. Unlike his brothers, Palin bears a strong resemblance to his late uncle Raceland, not only in appearance and intellect, but in his natural gift for magic. Caramon suspects that his summons has something to do with Palin. Palin is a novice magic user and has not yet taken the test that would allow him to advance in his magical career. According to Caramon, Palin's interest in magic is a phase which may yet pass. This isn't Caramon being in denial. Well, it sort of is. But this is what Palin has told his father. The wizards of the Conclave aren't fools, however. They are aware of Palin's talent, and that talent simply cannot be ignored. The wizards suspect that the gentle-hearted Palin is simply telling his father what he wants to hear, so his father will not fret. Palin knows that Caramon still feels the pain of losing his brother, although he has long since come to terms with his grief. Palin also knows that Caramon fears above all things to lose his youngest son the way he lost his twin brother. Palin is caught between his love for his father and his calling. Justerius suggests to Caramon that his love for his son makes him blind to his son's true potential. Justerius also points out that Palin is a much different person than his uncle. Whereas Raceland was sickly and weak, Palin is strong and healthy. Whereas Raceland was secretive and introverted, Palin is friendly and likable. Whereas Raceland's lonely and miserable upbringing made him angry and bitter, Palin was raised in a stable and loving family. Raceland's legacy is not a curse upon Palin. But all of this has been preamble. The primary reason Caramon has been summoned to this tower is that the wizards believe Raceland Majeure may still be alive. Hold up. Last we saw Raceland, he was in the abyss, with Caramon shutting the portal, trapping his brother inside, to be tortured by Tachesis, the Queen of Darkness, forever and ever and ever. Whether this qualifies as being quote-unquote alive, I'm not sure. Caramon rebuts this, saying his brother is dead. Just plain old, regular dead. According to Caramon, he received a vision from the god Paladine himself, which assured him that Raceland had repented of his sins at the very end and had sacrificed himself in an effort to atone for them. Paladine had rewarded Raceland for his sacrifice by granting him eternal peace instead of eternal torment. I wouldn't think Paladine has jurisdiction in the Abyss, but apparently Caramon believes so. Justerius then recounts the story of Raceland's own test in the Tower of High Sorcery, how he sacrificed a portion of his life force by allowing the undead spirit of the evil wizard Fistan Dantalus to inhabit his body. Caramon knows all this, but his sons do not. They have been summoned to the Conclave meeting just in time to overhear this story. Justerius argues that Raceland made his dark pact willingly, but Caramon believes he only did it to save his life. The purpose of all this back and forth, and why it matters whether Raceland is dead or trapped in the abyss, or whether he chose evil or evil chose him, is not merely an academic exercise. The Wizards' Conclave fear that Raceland, trapped in the abyss, is planning to use the same foul magic that Fistan Dantalus used to free his soul from the Dark Queen and to possess a new body on the mortal plane, the body of his nephew, Palin. Tonight is a special night, the Night of the Eye, a rare occurrence when all three moons are in alignment, creating the appearance of a huge red eye in the night sky. Justerius and Dunbar tell Palin that they wish to send him to the Tower of High Sorcery in Palanthas, so he can enter the portal and confront his uncle. They cannot allow him to take the test of high sorcery until they are sure he will not threaten the world as his uncle did. Dalimar takes Palin aside and warns Palin that the young wizard is being used as bait to lure Raceland into a trap so the wizards can put an end to him once and for all. Palin doesn't know who is telling the truth. Together, Palin, Caramon, and Dalimar travel via a magic spell to Palanthas. They enter the Tower of High Sorcery in the heart of the city, a tower long ago tainted with evil by a dark curse cast by a dying black-robed wizard. Dalimar explains that Raceland's laboratory, which contains the portal to the abyss, as well as the powerful staff of Magius, was sealed by him decades ago by a nearly unbreakable enchantment. But Dalimar believes that Raceland, even trapped in the abyss, has influence over the tower, and will be able to open the doors to the laboratory from the inside, allowing himself and Palin entry. As the group ascends the tower, Palin feels his confidence growing. He's always been the little brother, the coddled child, but he's enjoying his first taste of freedom and responsibility. When they reach the entrance to the laboratory, they are blocked by one of the undead specters who serve as guardians of the tower. After Raceland was trapped in the abyss, Dalimar gave the key to this laboratory to this specter and told him to let no one enter, Dalimar included. The specter refuses to let Dalimar enter, but, seeing Palin, he summons the young wizard to approach. Caramon attempts to stop Palin, but Palin lashes out at his father. He accuses his father of holding him back from pursuing his interest in magic, of trying to prevent his son from becoming the mage he's always dreamt he might be. He knows Caramon has done this out of fear, fear that the magic would destroy Palin as it destroyed Raistlin. Palin refuses to retreat, but instead approaches the specter. The specter gives Palin the key to the laboratory. As Palin prepares to enter, two more specters appear, preventing Dalimar from following. Dalimar warns Palin not to enter alone, but Palin ignores the warning and enters Raistlin's laboratory. No one has entered this room in 25 years. A layer of dust covers the spellbooks and magical artifacts which remain here from Raistlin's time. Nothing has been disturbed, yet something is awake here. The Staff of Magius, an ancient staff which was created by the wizard Magius and ultimately given to Raistlin Magier, glows brightly, light emitting from the crystal on top. Palin approaches and takes hold of the staff, feeling its power within him. The light of the staff directs his gaze to the corner of the laboratory, to a purple curtain hiding something behind it. He hears a voice calling to him, pulling him closer. When he draws the curtain aside, he finds the portal to the abyss, a black void in the center of five sculpted dragon heads, glowing white, red, blue, black, and green. The lights begin to glow with a blinding colorful brilliance and swirl around the black center. Palin feels himself being swallowed by that void, pulled in against his will, into the abyss itself. Palin wakens in the abyss, recognizing it from his father's stories of his journey there many years ago. Palin witnesses two undead creatures chaining a black-robed figure to a wall. The figure's white hair and gold skin are enough for Palin to know that this must be his uncle. A woman appears, a beautiful yet repulsive woman, the Queen of Darkness. As Palin watches, she transforms into a five-headed dragon and, with a swipe of her claw, disembowels Palin's uncle before his eyes. Her daily torture complete, she leaves Raistlin to die. Temporarily, anyway. He'll come back to life in the morning, only to be killed again. This is the torture he has endured daily ever since he chose to remain on this plane. Palin approaches and manages to free his uncle despite vomiting several times at the sight of Raistlin's organs sticking out. It's never a reassuring sign when the person who's come to rescue you can't stop puking at the sight of you. Palin manages to get a hold of himself, however, and is amazed to see that Raistlin's wound is beginning to heal. The presence of someone good and loving can work miracles in the abyss. Together, the two magic users escape back through the portal. Back in the laboratory, Palin's first thought is to close the portal to the abyss to prevent the Dark Queen from busting out once she realizes the door is open. Raistlin, strangely, is in no hurry. He speaks to Palin about Palin's relationship with his father. Raistlin knows that Palin must be his father's favorite because of the resemblance Palin has to Raistlin, Caramon's beloved brother. Raistlin also knows that Caramon will smother Palin with that love, the way he once did Raistlin. Raistlin tells Palin that the wizards of the Conclave are wrong about his motives. Raistlin does not want to possess Palin. He wants to take Palin on as his apprentice. Raistlin bequeaths the staff of Magius to his nephew to keep for his own. Also, Raistlin claims that he did not sacrifice himself out of a desire for redemption. He did it because he knew that one day he might be able to escape. Now is his chance. With Palin at his side, he will allow the Dark Queen through the portal and into Kryn. This will prove his loyalty to the Queen, and she will reward him by making him ruler of the world. Raistlin once intended to become a god, but he learned a valuable lesson in humility. Now he just wants to be king of the planet instead. Palin is horrified. He refuses to go along with his uncle's insane plan. He approaches the portal, planning to use the staff to close it once again. Raistlin warns him not to. Raistlin threatens him, saying he will kill him if he must. Palin chooses to die rather than to be complicit in such an evil undertaking. Raistlin unleashes the force of his magic at his nephew, and Palin sinks into darkness. When Palin awakens, he is back outside the laboratory with his father and Dalimar. The laboratory doors are still closed. The guardian remains at his post. Palin is bewildered and confused. Dalimar explains to Palin that everything he experienced in the laboratory was an illusion. Palin never broke the enchantment, never entered, never traveled to the abyss, never met Raceland. It was all a fabrication created by the wizards. This was Palin's test, and he passed. The wizards of the Conclave knew that Palin needed to be tested, and they knew Caramon would never allow it. Thus, this elaborate ruse. They wanted to see if the temptation to power that existed in the uncle existed in the nephew as well, or if Palin was, after all, his father's son. Palin has earned his place in the Order of the White Robes. Dalimar assures Palin that the wizards have no reason to believe that Raceland is still alive, and that they believe Caramon's vision of Raceland's peaceful death was genuine. Unknown to all, Dalimar's spell to conjure an illusion of Raceland Majeure was much more than a mere facsimile. Raceland Majeure has briefly entered the mortal world once again, if only to act out his part in Palin's test. With his task done, Raceland returns to his sleep, but not before giving his minions in the tower one last instruction. As Palin, Dalimar, and Caramon eat breakfast, the laboratory guardian knocks on the door. The specter tells Palin he has something for him. From the darkness, he summons the Staff of Magius and presents it to Palin. A gift from the true master of the tower. Part 3. Wanna Bet? Our next story begins about a month after the events of the Legacy. Tannen and Sturm Majeure are on a trip to Cathal Uthwistan, seat of Gunthar, Grand Master of the Knights of Salamnia, where they will officially join the knighthood. The two warriors, along with their younger brother Palin, now an official White Robe Mage, stop at an inn called the Spliced Jib in the city of Sandcrest to spend the night before continuing onto the castle in the morning. The Spliced Jib is your typical filthy inn, the kind of place where young adventurers without a lot of money usually wind up. There is some unusual clientele, however. The brothers soon notice a gaudily dressed dwarf keeping company with small brown-robed Jawa-like creatures. The dwarf notices the brothers as well and approaches, inviting them to share a drink with him. Not wanting to appear rude, the brothers agree. The dwarf, who introduces himself as Dugan Redhammer, is a very unusual dwarf. Instead of being gruff and taciturn, Dugan is gregarious and flamboyant, not only in his dress, but in his personality as well. The new friends begin to share Dugan's bottle of dwarf spirits, a powerful liquor made from fermented mushrooms. It isn't long before Dugan, who may or may not have a full-blown gambling addiction, decides to propose a wager. Dugan will try to personally drink all three brothers under the table. Whoever loses pays the bar tab. Whoever wins has to help the loser, or losers, to bed. Full of youthful brashness, the brothers agree, Palin reluctantly, and the drinking contest commences. Needless to say, the brothers lose the bet. Dwarf spirits are like mother's milk to dwarves. They never really had a chance. They wake up in the hold of a ship already at sea, bound hand and foot with massive hangovers. Hearing them stirring, Dugan appears from above and explains that he has honored the terms of the wager by helping them to bed, just not to their beds. He cuts their brothers free from their bonds and explains that they aren't prisoners. Rather, he's recruited them to join on his quest. Initially, the brothers refuse. Dugan says they cannot refuse, it's a matter of honor. They lost the bet, and the payment he requires is their assistance. Reluctantly, the brothers consent to aid Dugan in his quest. Going above deck, the brothers discover that they are on a ship built and crewed by gnomes. The small brown-robed figures the brothers saw at the inn were, in fact, gnomes in disguise. The ship, called the Miracle, is a wonder of gnomish engineering, which has somehow managed to be slower and harder to steer than a normal ship. Dugan explains that he, and now they, are on a quest to recover a legendary magical artifact called the Grey Gem of Gargath. Palin tells the story for the benefit of his brothers and, of course, the reader. Originally, the universe was dominated by a force called Chaos, which was eventually organized into good, evil, and neutrality. The god Hadouken convinced the god Reorx to capture some of the essence of Chaos into a gem. Although Dugan says this part of the story is wrong, it was actually the god Morgion who convinced Reorx. Anyway, Reorx created the Grey Gem and placed it on the surface of the Red Moon, Lunatari. According to the legend, the gnomes were originally humans, transformed by Reorx as punishment for their shoddy workmanship. The gnomes coveted the Grey Gem and attempted to build a rocket to fly to the moon, but lacked an adequate power source. Instead, they created an enormous ladder and climbed to the moon. But the Grey Gem escaped and ran amok through Kryn, causing havoc and mutating all kinds of people, plants, and animals into new races and beings. As it happened, the Grey Gem was responsible for transforming the gnomes into the two races of dwarves and kender. Eventually, the Grey Gem was captured by a human wizard named Gargath, who took it to an island far to the west, also called Gargath. Dugin claims that the dwarves tell the story differently. According to the dwarves, they were created by Reorx personally to be his favored people. The Grey Gem was intended to be a gift from Reorx to his chosen, but the gnomes stole it and then subsequently lost it. But Dugin tells a third story. According to Dugin's third story, Morgion tricked Reorx into creating the Grey Gem, then lost possession of the gem to Morgion in a game of dice. Morgion set the Grey Gem loose, thinking that the influence of chaos upon Kryn would increase his own power. Regardless of how the story is told, the outcome is the same. The Grey Gem has come to rest on the island called Gargath, and that is where the miracle is headed. The miracle soon reaches the Isle of Gargath and crashes right into it. While the gnomes get to work repairing the ship, Dugin and the Majir boys disembark. They are immediately halted by a group of armed warriors. The adventurers are ready for a fight, but these warriors seem strangely unenthusiastic about the whole thing. Before anyone can throw a punch or cast a spell, some children emerge from the village, making annoying demands of their fathers, the kinds of annoying demands typically reserved for mothers. The warriors stand down and invite the newcomers to the village. The adventurers learn from the locals that Gargath has compelled the villages to send all of their women to his castle at the center of the island. The Majir brothers agree that they will travel to Gargath's castle with Dugin and free the women, while the villagers remain behind to care for the children. As the group travels from village to village, moving ever closer to Gargath's castle, they hear the same story everywhere. But the situation on the island isn't the only strange thing going on. Palin is becoming obsessed with the magical power he might possess by obtaining the Grey Gem. Tannen can only think about selling the Grey Gem for a tremendous fortune. Sturm is only interested in the beautiful women who will surely reward their handsome rescuers. But this is all out of character for the three brothers. Palin knows the Grey Gem is too powerful for anyone to wield. Tannen isn't interested in acquiring fabulous wealth. And, as a prospective knight, Sturm has taken a vow of celibacy until marriage. Dugin tells them that this is the Grey Gem itself, trying to influence them and control their will. At last, the four adventurers reach Gargath Castle. The appearance and structure of the castle and the grounds surrounding it are constantly shifting, constantly changing. Only the power of the Staff of Magius, wielded by Palin, is able to stabilize the immediate area enough that they can gain entry into the castle without the floor suddenly transforming into a bottomless pit, or a door suddenly transforming into a solid wall as they walk through it. Exploring the castle, the brothers and the dwarf find the missing women who were given by the villages as a kind of tribute to Gargath. The women are very delighted to find four handsome men suddenly in their midst, since it's been 2 years since some of them have laid eyes on a man. There is a lot of flirting and suggestive innuendos, but the brothers resist temptation. Talking to the quote-unquote prisoners, the adventurers learn that the women enjoy being here in the castle. They have been basically running the place for the last 2 years. Gargath has an extensive library, and the women have found it much more satisfying to live lives of ease and comfort, discussing poetry and philosophy, than taking care of the children while their husbands are off killing each other in war. As for the lord of the castle himself, they found him to be a bore and locked him in the highest tower along with the Grey Gem. The adventurers press onward, determined to find Gargath and the Grey Gem. They finally reach Gargath's chambers. Entering, they find that a magical circle on the floor keeps the Grey Gem suspended in the air, its power contained within the confines of the circle. The gem itself seems to constantly change its size and shape as it emits a strange gray light. In the center of the circle is a throne, upon which sits Gargath himself. Like the Grey Gem, Gargath is also constantly changing, from a hedgehog to a dragon to a snake to a gully dwarf and on and on. Gargath explains that, although he has the Grey Gem contained, it's really calling the shots. The gem is using Gargath, the women in the castle, and even the warriors of the island, all to protect itself from the one person who has been seeking the Grey Gem all these years, the one who created it, the god Reorx. Or, as he's known to his friends, Dugin Redhammer. The gem tries to use its power against Dugan by turning the three Majeur brothers, the women of the tower, and Gargath against him. The gem begins to drive everyone mad with a desire to destroy Dugan, promising each person whatever it is they want most. Dugan is able to break the enchantment long enough to propose a simple wager to the gem. If he loses, he will release the gem to spread havoc across the world again. If he wins, he will take possession of the gem. He proposes that Palin Majeur will be able to throw Dugan's warhammer into the air and that it will remain in the air of its own accord. Palin is forbidden to use his magic to achieve this and assumes it's impossible. So does the Grey Gem. It agrees to the bet. With no other choice, Palin takes hold of the end of the warhammer and begins to spin in a circle, using centrifugal force to get the hammer off the ground. But he can't do much more than that. The hammer slips from his grasp and goes flying from his hands, only to begin spinning around the perimeter of the room, moving higher and higher. The hammer, the same one which forged the Grey Gem, is drawn to the gem by a kind of magnetic attraction between the two. The hammer strikes the gem with a tremendous burst of red and gray light, and both fall to the floor. Dugan catches the gem in midair, and the power of the Grey Gem is broken at last. Once the gnomish ship is repaired, Dugan and the three brothers set sail back toward Ancelon. The brothers ask Dugan to let them see the Grey Gem, for which they suffered so much, but Dugan refuses to show them. One night, the brothers accost Dugan, demanding to see the gem. Unfortunately, that won't be possible. Embarrassed, Dugan confesses to the three brothers the true reason he hasn't let them see it. Before leaving the island, he wagered the gem in a game of dice, and lost. The Grey Gem is loose in the world once again. All right, this is where we're going to leave off for today. Check back in a week for part two of The Second Generation, when we will be discussing the final two novellas in this collection, as well as discussing the book as a whole. If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon subscriber by visiting patreon.com/dandbookclub. That's D-A-N-D-D Book Club. For $5 a month, you'll get access to exclusive Magic the Gathering novel episodes, and you'll be helping to support the podcast. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach me at dndbookclub@gmail.com or follow me on Instagram at dndbookclub. That's our show for today, and until next time, be nice to the people around you. You never know who might be a god in disguise.